From St. Mary's University of Minnesota, you're listening to St. Mary's Currents. I'm your host, Ben Rogers. Data breaches seem to be pervasive across the U.S. The Minnetonka-based United Health Group breach in February was so large, in fact, that according to the Minnesota Attorney General's office, resulted in millions of Minnesotans, quote, health and personal data being leaked onto the dark web, a hidden portion of the internet where cybercriminals buy, sell, and track personal information, end quote.
The CEO of a Minnesota company spent the day saying sorry to Congress for a massive cyber attack.
Lawmakers questioned Andrew Witte about the company's huge cybersecurity breach last February that put the data of up to a third of all Americans in jeopardy.
Cybercriminals entered a Change Healthcare portal, exfiltrated data, and on February the 21st deployed ransomware.
With other 2024 hacks to AT&T.
Tonight, a massive data breach of 73 million current and former AT&T customers.
Ticketmaster.
New details today on that massive data breach impacting loads of Ticketmaster customers, a hacking group now claiming responsibility.
And regionally to Minnesota Department of Education.
Tonight, another data breach, this time at the Minnesota Department of Education. Officials say hackers.
Minneapolis-based MNGI Digestive Health. In social service programs in 18 Minnesota counties, it can be difficult to understand how to feel or respond to the volume of information being stolen, and what to do if your information is compromised.
Allison Nixon is chief research officer at a cybersecurity firm that focuses on cyber criminals.
The level of cybercrime has risen to the point where it feels overwhelming, and every year it gets worse. And it feels like, as defenders, it's almost like we're winning every battle and losing the war.
Today, we're joined by Dr. John Eber, Program Director of the MS in Data Intelligence and Geoanalytics Program here at St. Mary's. Dr. Eber talks with us about how data breaches occur, the impact they have on businesses and individuals, and what steps can be taken to protect your information. John, thank you so much for joining us today. Before we dive into this topic, can you introduce yourself to our listeners and, you know, let them know what you do here at St. Mary's, your professional background, and what your academic interests are?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks a lot, Ben, for the nice warm welcome and introduction. My name is Dr. John Ebert. I've been with St. Mary's here for over 20 years now, and time flies when we're having fun, as they say. But my time at St. Mary's has largely been really rooted in the fields of science and technology, primarily with geospatial technology and now emerging AI and whatnot. But most recently, related to our topic today, that of cybersecurity. And looking back prior to my time at St. Mary's, I was a technologist and conservation director for a local county government and also served on land information committees for the county professionally, you know, adding something of flair for the school and outreach, you know, volunteering and whatnot. But also spent a lot of time working with partners and various stakeholders over the years on different types of consulting from the school, that is, and outreach. And then, of course, doing a lot of different types of R&D that relates to AI really a lot more, but then the geospatial aspects, data science and whatnot.
Very nice. Let's dive into our topic. So as we mentioned earlier, today we're discussing something that most people hope they never have to receive a notice about, right? Cybersecurity data breaches. So back in February, United Health Group was targeted by a cybersecurity attack. In a Star Tribune article, it is said that one in three Americans may have had their data accessed as a result of this attack. And, you know, in the intro, I mentioned there were a number of large national groups like Ticketmaster, AT&T. So we're looking at a lot of people who are impacted by these. Most of our listeners may be aware of things like this, cybersecurity attacks, data breaches, but could you explain what they are and kind of how they typically occur?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a little more challenging to be on the outside looking into each one of those individual instances because they're all so unique, also always very specific. But a lot of those companies, when a breach occurs, they don't necessarily want to let the cat out of the bag, metaphorically saying, here's what happened and here's why it happened and everything that was compromised. A lot of that is damage control, but a lot of that is also not wanting to release information to threat actors, you know, giving them greater access to information. But with percentages of organizations or people that have had their data breached or compromised, in today's era, hate to kind of say it like this, but it's kind of a matter of when it's going to happen, not if, because our data is out there digitally in so many different facets. And I can share more about everything from biometrics to what types of things are going on out there that we need to prepare ourselves for, and really limiting the amount of information that we choose to put out there is really a decision that we all need to take to heart. The more information that's out there, the more difficult it will be to contain. But typically with data breaches, with respect to your commentary about the UnitedHealth breach, that was an instance, if I recall, of just a simple credential hack. And without knowing all the exact super specifics of that, it was just failure to have a process in place, like a two-factor authentication that would limit someone from, you know, trying to pretend that whether it's social engineering or me pretending that it's you, but somehow gaining access to credentials to get into that healthcare situation. So much of it is just based on having a good plan. You know, making sure, you know, a lot of things that I see out there, we tend to say, well, that's not going to happen to me. You know, it's kind of that old adage of saying, you know, if you're outrunning a bear, you just have to hope that you're faster than the next person that you're by. And that's kind of the way it is, where I've had a lot of people say, gosh, you know, that information's out there. I don't really need to do anything about it because if somebody really wants it, they'll gain access to my material or my information. Perhaps that's true with some of those things floating out there, but it's about being proactive. It's about having a plan organizationally, but as a consumer, as a, you know, citizen or whatnot, it's about being proactive. Extracting or, you know, getting into these databases, which social security numbers are compromised, all addresses, you know, your name and things like that. These are prime opportunities for threat actors or really what I kind of think of as identity theft. And there are millions and millions of social security numbers, personal information released, and it's a little bit dangerous. So the moral of the story is, you know, I've suggested and shared out information with friends, family, community, networks, ways that you could basically just freeze your credit, you know, is a great way to protect yourself. Log on to Experian, TransUnion, Equifax. It's as simple as just setting up an account and freezing your credit. It's being mindful. It's being proactive. It's limiting the amount of impact that a threat actor or anyone else can have with your information.
Right. So you mentioned each one is kind of different when it comes to what the attack usually looks like. But how do businesses become aware of them?
You know, it's kind of sad. Usually they become aware after the fact, which is what we're trying in cybersecurity to do, is to be proactive and not reactive. And more often than not, small businesses, small to mid-size businesses are the target, either through phishing or social engineering, which about 80% typically is where we see a lot of those. I'll refer to them as just hacks, if you will, on data or data breaches, where someone is using phishing, you know, just login credentials, like what happened at United.
Yeah.
You know, something along those lines. Something that could be easily mitigated by that two-factor authentication, which is just another form of identity to gain access to whatever platform or network or whatever it might be that a business is operating on. One of the biggest things is ransomware. In other words, hey, we're going to hold your data and we're going to hold you at ransom until you pay us X number of dollars. So small businesses are definitely targets. And oftentimes threat actors or quote unquote hacking groups like to identify and study organizations before they actually create a breach. It's often said that these groups don't want to financially bankrupt any of these organizations because then they know they can't hold them ransom. These groups are very careful. You know, they want to see operations and they want to know what they can pull and what they think they can get away with. They want to make it an inconvenience that an organization may be willing to pay up rather than to, let's say, okay, we'll have to go to our data backups or recreate all of our data. So it's just inconvenient enough that they know that the odds are slightly, I'll say, on the hacker side, if you will, to really gain access to that data. And with ransomware on the uptick, there are groups who work with, I'll call them third-party contractors, to develop either malicious software or AI algorithms or whatever it is. They have a particular idea, and so they farm out a way to intrude an organization for their data. And that's really a scary thing when we start to think about AI and malware and how threat actors are using what we believe is the intent for good technology, but how it's really being used in a nefarious way. And so I was talking about AI and security, whether it's cybersecurity or generally national security. I mean, all things are security related, but when you think of technology as it improves, it creates really a cat and mouse game of threat actors versus the good intent of what technology was originally designed to do. And so we're seeing one group advance and then the other group counters. And so that ratcheting upward is a little frightening, but it also can be used for good, too, to combat any potential threats or things of that nature.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I have a question related to that coming up a bit later. But as you mentioned, real quick, you know, we were talking the cost of ransomware, right? So in the United Healthcare incident, CBS News reported, overall, it cost the organization $872 million. And I'm sure that they're probably looking at costs beyond that, you know, as these things continue to grow. So what are the impacts for businesses hit by these sorts of attacks?
Yeah, I mean, it goes more, obviously people, whether it's stakeholders or investors or organizations, are looking at their fiscal bottom line. But, you know, there's that element of public damage too. And, you know, how do those organizations curtail that? And it's brand, you know, it's a brand of what you're known for. So I think there's a careful dance around that. Like with United, for instance, and I'm not a healthcare expert or anything like that, but they're more of the middle organization that's handling your healthcare records or bills or insurance or whatnot between patients and providers. So what really hit them hard was that when they were down, there were lack of, I'll just call it, fiscal or monetary flow from bottom to middle and then middle to top and vice versa. And so the loss of that workflow is really what was a fiscal challenge for United. And I think it remains to be seen, you know, what will happen ultimately with that. But it's always that awareness of where are the impacts? And it's, of course, with patient confidentiality and where are those medical records or claims or whatever it is. You know, I don't know the extent to which what was all released or compromised, but what happens then? What do we provide for, you know, digital protection, you know, asset protection or whatever for consumers? So it's all about having a good plan that outlines for an organization, if something happens, then what do we do? You know, and the scary part is a lot of companies have not, despite what we would like to hope and see with the rise of the interest in cybersecurity, you know, a lot of organizations do not have this yet refined. I mean, just look at the United example, and I'm not trying to imply that United doesn't have anything altogether, because that's certainly not the case. But so I want to be mindful of stating that. But whether it was one particular activity or whether it was organization-wide, you know, having something like a two-factor authentication is really helpful, and just having a bigger, more robust security plan. So, but wanted to make that very evident that, you know, no way this is anything disparaging towards United Health.
Great point there. So, again, it was reported 1 in 3 Americans may have been impacted by this breach. And with bigger companies like this, more people are always going to be impacted. So, what are the immediate and long-term impacts of a data breach on an individual whose information has been compromised?
Yeah, I think it really depends what it is. If data was more on the public side, well, it's probably not that big of a deal. But when we're getting into, you know, whether it's medical records or arguably Social Security numbers with the NPD breach here a few months back with Social Security numbers and whatnot, you know, then that becomes kind of an identity theft type of thing. And so, but there's practice like we spoke of, you know, with putting credit freezes and whatnot. But then there's, you know, the other personal information that's out there, whether it's medical records or whatever it is. Once that's out there, there's no guarantee. And that's, I guess, part of the plan of an organization to figure out, okay, well, what does that mean long-term for us? You know, what dangers does that provide? And ultimately, that depends who ends up with that data. You know, a number of years back with the genealogy companies like 23andMe, they were subjected to a data breach or a hack, if you will, And on the dark web, they were selling genetic information to anyone who was interested in individual accounts for, I think it was like $5 or $10 per record. And, you know, I'd have to state something that while 23andMe and the allure of finding out, you know, who you're related to and everything, I personally would not recommend it. I always say like this, you can walk away from a computer if you need to. You know, you can walk away from your digital footprint of who you are on the computer, if you will, but you can't walk away from who you are and what you're made of. And what's really kind of scary about that is with genetic information, despite what we want to believe, there are individuals, sadly, out there in the world who do not always have that forward thinking for the good of humanity forthcoming in their mind. So a lot of genetic information can be used, obviously, for pharmaceuticals, developing cures, you know, and things like that. But there's also more of the dark side of that to figure out, okay, where are genetic populations more alike? Where are they different? Where's the homogeneity? Where's the different types of pockets of people? And it's a little bit alarming, but there has been some concern a little bit over different types of biologics that could be developed for the wrong reasons. You know, for targeting people with different backgrounds and how you can do that quietly, you know, just based on your genetic code, your genetic sequence. So These are alarming things that are out there. They're probably not on the front page every day, but I would say for something that's a long-term breach, like who you are and your DNA and stuff like that, that's a little scary. So my own personal advice is I wouldn't offer to put that stuff out there because it's not worth it to have that stuff floating around out there.
We'll be right back in a minute.
The business world changes fast, and technology advances every single day. In these evolving fields, you need a skill set that not only keeps up with your career goals and busy life, but also gets you ahead. At St. Mary's University of Minnesota, our flexible programs can help you do just that. The School of Business and Technology offers bachelor's, degree completion, master's, and doctoral degrees for whatever career level and life stage you're in. Explore our programs in analytics, management, leadership, advanced technology, and more. At St. Mary's, you'll learn how to become a leader who ensures that business and tech are led with ethics and principles to ensure opportunities for all. Here, students learn to do good and lead great. Join us by visiting smumn.edu. St. Mary's University of Minnesota, because of you.
As you know, we found files in the exfiltrated data containing protected health information and personally identifiable information, which could cover a substantial proportion of people in America. So far, we have not seen evidence that materials such as doctors' charts or full medical histories were exfiltrated. It will take several months before enough information will be available to identify and notify impacted customers and individuals.
So when something like this happens, what kind of immediate steps, and maybe not even immediate, but what sorts of steps, once you have been notified that your data has been compromised, what sort of steps do you want to take?
People don't really know that. A compromised individual, you may receive a letter or something like that, that your organization or your business has been compromised. Here are some things that you may want to do. And it is difficult to know what goes on behind those doors and who has access to your information and what they're going to do with it. I really think it's being, I'll come back to this, about being proactive about monitoring your credit scores you know, locking down information about yourself that makes it a little bit more inconvenient for a threat actor or someone who is up to no good, you know, that would want your information, anything that makes it an inconvenience. Like with this MPD breach we were talking about a little bit earlier, there are millions, millions. And you can look yourself up. I encourage anybody who's listening to the podcast, look up MPD data breach, and there'll be a number of websites from trusted news articles or other web links where you can look up your information very simply with your name, birth year, and state. And you there can identify any information that was released about you to that group, to the U.S., I think it was DOD there, if I remember right. Again, non-governmental cyber group. So you look to see what's all been done and then what you can do about it, which, again, kind of comes back to protecting your, ultimately, your credit. But the groups or individuals who may have access to your data or information, it's all about convenience for them. If there's something inconvenient, if they pull up Ben Rogers' information and they try to apply for a mortgage or a credit card or some type of a loan and are switching addresses and are manipulative with the different schemes that are out there of rerouting credit cards very carefully without even the actual person knowing about it, they're pretty clever about that. But if somebody's pulling a credit report on you for a loan or a credit line or something like that, and those things are frozen, to that threat actor, it becomes way too inconvenient to go forward with that. So what are they going to do? They're going to look to the next person who chose not to do anything to be proactive because they're an easier target. So I think it comes down to don't make yourself an easy target. Make your information more difficult. Create two-factor authentication at a minimum with your login, especially at work with your employer, but even on your own email, your own mobile devices, you know, which is another threat that's out there. We see threats all over the place now with more remote work going on. And how are we handling remote access, mobile devices, IoT, you know, Internet of Things devices that are out there collecting data? These are all key holes to gain access to different infrastructures that are out there. But yeah, I think it's taking a look at pulling up resources, looking, what can I do to make my information a little bit more inconvenient?
Absolutely. So we kind of discussed this earlier. We mentioned about the rises in technology and specifically artificial intelligence being one of the big ones.
Yeah.
With these technologies on the rise, could that build a bigger potential for these sort of attacks? And if that's the case, you know, could these technologies also help prevent these sorts of attacks?
Typically, with intrusion detection, specifically speaking, in other words, how are organizations looking at what's coming into their network, whether it's cloud or local or whatever it is that they may have, AI or probably more so machine learning, these machine learning algorithms are going to be looking for, I'll call it traffic, that will be coming through their system of being odd or data packets that are coming through that just are a little bit different than what is typically, you know, coming through the system. So it's creating algorithms that are learning what's normal within an organization and then being able to create a stopgap when something isn't there. So AI is going to enable us to become more proactive than reactive. And so there are a lot of good companies out there that are capitalizing on this too, companies like CrowdStrike and whatnot, that whether it's the government or different organizations, companies will hire a third party like CrowdStrike to actively monitor this for them. So they create an instant stopgap to prevent intrusions. And before, a lot of these stopgaps were a little bit more immediate, like with the AI and whatnot, companies had the choice of, and they still do, of paying cyber insurance. So, you know, it's like paying insurance for your car. But what's happened is the rates have skyrocketed because of how fast technology is growing and how companies without good plans are kind of sitting ducks if they're not really proactive in building their plans and infrastructures for how to deal with the cyber attack. And sometimes they just may not have a lot of money if they're a small business. And that's why a lot of groups are attacking small, mid-sized businesses, because they know they don't have the infrastructure in place. But with AI and the machine learning with these different third-party groups, it becomes easier to then detect threats before they become a problem. So that's the exciting thing about AI. And of course, the other side of it is, while we haven't seen a whole lot of it in sophistication yet from threat actors, it is definitely coming, and probably more of the advanced, I'll call it hacker groups or bad actor groups out there, they probably have a little bit more access to AI capabilities. than do just rogue phishing types of schemes or social engineering where they're saying, oh, hey, Ben, I know this person in your group, and they asked me to get some credentials for your Google Drive site or whatnot, and could you share your login credentials with me so that I can, you know, get into that? So that's not really significant AI just at that level, but where AI is looking specifically is at a lot of details. And in new eras of quantum computing, for instance, not to go too deep into this, but typically, you know, data that is coming in is in little bytes with zeros and ones, you know, with data packets and whatnot. And where quantum computing really is kind of changing that in a little bit more of a complex manner, such that with quantum computing, you're dealing with qubits, where the information can be different places at different times. And so rather than just zeros and ones, it could be multiple things at different times. So it poses a unique challenge for how systems are able to detect different types of intrusions now, and yet then how could we better protect those? So that's obviously maybe another chat for a different podcast, but definitely of interest in trends coming down the line for sure.
Absolutely. So there is potential that these can help stop these, but in the here and now, what kind of like best practices should companies consider implementing to prevent data breaches?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, something that everybody should hear the answers to this. And I mean, my answers are not necessarily the one-all be-all, you know, on websites, you know, that you could find all these things too. But first thing is have a plan. Organizationally, have a plan and enable access to something like a two-factor authentication. You know, we at the school here, we have our own app that we use, but sometimes, you know, you'll get a text message with your verification code, you know, or how, would you like us to call you or text you or whatever it is. That's an example of that. Other things are having strong passwords. You know, I mean, it kind of goes with a little bit of a side chuckle there when people say, oh, yeah, I have a password, 1234, your street address or whatever it is, or your kid's name or your whatever. But it's being mindful of that. For something fun, if you're interested in doing this for anybody that's listening, run a little web search on, you know, how easily a password can be cracked. And you'll be surprised that, you know, obviously the longer the digits, the special characters, the upper lowercase, it could take years to crack some, where others are simple within, you know, 5 seconds, 10 seconds. But again, it's that inconvenience factor that I was speaking to, is making access to your personal data more inconvenient. And that oftentimes is the best strategy. So having and using strong passwords, organizationally speaking, it's updating your security guidelines, maybe on your networks or your organizational-wide, your computer infrastructures, software updates that may have gaps or limitations, your mobile devices. More today than ever before, people are running almost everything off their phones. So it's being mindful of what we're putting out there and just being conscientious of how we're able to regulate our mobile devices, whether it's passwords or whatever it may be. And then another quiet one that doesn't get talked about a lot is the zero trust, which basically means it's not that we don't trust anybody, but we don't trust anybody in our organization. So we want to limit access to important information to only those individuals who need to use it, whether that's either credentials or access to certain files or cloud folders, or if we're in the Google Drive or something, only certain people have access to it type of a thing. And this is done mostly from, I think, a standpoint of having someone accidentally do something, inadvertently access a folder or share a folder that they shouldn't, and then that falls into hands that it shouldn't. And it may just be done inadvertently, and the person doesn't even know it. And then, of course, the flip side of that is inside of organizations, occasionally people may have access to different accounts, different financials. And could it be sometimes where someone is compromising your organization from the inside? There are some statistics out there on this, depending on the size of the organization, too. While it's a little bit smaller, breaches can happen from an inside actor. So in some organizations, they'll have a rotating carousel of people working in different accounts so that they can monitor whether fraudulent financials are coming in or going out. And by rotating staff, it's a way of still protecting the data, the organization, customer information or patient information, whatever it may be. It's not too uncommon where you could go in and look in the news and find instances where people that have access to different funds or different accounts, stuff can kind of happen. You know, they're borrowing money or taking some out and they say, well, nobody's going to find out about this. So that stuff does happen. And so when we limit that information or we have multiple people or you're kind of rotating a carousel of different accounts, it puts a lid on potential problems, I guess. So those are some things that I think are really a ground zero to think about in any type of plan. And it's knowing your risks. What can we live with? What can't we live with? And, you know, where do we fall in that background? But, and of course, training. If you have training opportunities, that really decreases the likelihood of someone serving up their credentials to someone that's trying to socially engineer them or run through some application of a phishing or smishing technique, which is, you know, just kind of mining your credentials through text messaging or the otherwise through email or something like that.
Well, John, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciated having you.
Thank you.
You know, I know our listeners who might be concerned about this. Again, you know, this is something that can happen to anyone. I'm sure they are so appreciative of your insight. Again, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It was a joy to be here with you today, Ben, and look forward to a great up and coming year, hopefully cybersecurity breach free.
St. Mary's Currents is a production of the St. Mary's University of Minnesota Office of Marketing and Communication. It is produced by Ben Rogers and Ashley Beeson. It is recorded, edited, and engineered by Jeffrey DeMarsh. Our theme music is by Will Vandekramer. I'm Ben Rogers. We'll see you next time for St. Mary's Currents.